Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 132, with guests from Film Spotting and Larson on Film, Josh Larson. Joining him from the Real World Theology Network podcast, Body and Blood, Blake Collier. So listen up, because we've got an action-packed show for you. On this episode, we talk The Fate of the Furious and Bro Bliss.
But I'm glad you're back, Josh. I didn't... it's one of those things where I feel like it's at some point I'm going to have someone back on, but I feel like I can never find the timing and the fact that you reached out and said that you wanted to talk about any of the Fast and Furious movies actually really surprised me. Maybe that's because I have an incredibly erroneous view of the films that you like to talk about. Or, you know, there was some motivation that I didn't understand. So I'm actually kind of curious, like, what it is about, like, these movies that, of all the movies that you could have come on the podcast again to talk about, award-winning, you know, critically acclaimed films, like, why would you want to talk about the Fast and the Furious movies?
So I was a fan of the very first one, you know, not enormous fan, but mm-hmm. I gave it a pretty good review at the time and appreciated its genre commitment and the clarity of action it had. And really right from the start, the camaraderie between Vin Diesel and Paul Walker. So mm-hmm. already had a sort of a soft spot for it, but I didn't really follow the series very much after that. And it did gain in some critical circles a certain appreciation as the series went on. And I found that curious and, you know, wondered what it was about, caught one here or there. It really wasn't until Furious 7 when I did what you guys did a few years ago and looked at the whole franchise in one big, you know, take and thought, what is going on here? Why are these movies... Clearly, they were audience hits, but why are they also gaining some sort of critical following? And there's actually a lot there to appreciate from a structural, formal perspective. And if you're a fan of action movies at all, you know, that's a genre where so many of them are done poorly. And
it's true.
When you find ones that are done with craft and clarity and precision and skill, that's a rare thing. And for the most part, you know, not every Fast and Furious movie is full of this sort of stuff, but for the most part, I think each installment has managed to pull that off.
So I'm really kind of curious what some of those things were. I know you wrote an article for Think Christian, and we'll definitely link to that in the show notes. But if you could kind of give us the big picture view of what you saw, because I really think when we talk about the Fast and the Furious franchise, most people say, well, that's an example, like we say so many times on the show, that's a movie you just go, you get the biggest tub of popcorn and the biggest soda you can, you turn your brain off, because there ain't nothing coming through but cars blowing up for no reason. There's nothing going on there, there's no connection, nothing. Like, that is the example of the one that you can't do a real-world theology about, you can't examine theme, because it's just mindless action. And yet you're saying, and obviously we would agree because people can go back and listen to our episode on Furious 7 as well, but you're saying that there's something more there.
Yeah, I guess I would also argue you don't necessarily need to have theme to mm-hmm. make a movie interesting or important. That's certainly one of the elements, but there are thematic things maybe we'll get into. I know you were interested in possibly talking about how family fits in this latest, The Fate of the Furious. So that's there to a degree, but really it's more, these movies are more formally interesting to me. And the way I've come to describe them is they manage this idea of Zen chaos. So even though there's just ridiculous stuff going on, it achieves this sublime state where we're watching these impossible action being depicted on the screen, with, again, just this uncommon clarity and precision and control. So you always know what's happening in one of these crazy car chases or races. You know where people are, you know why something happened. And the point of comparison I always give is the Michael Bay Transformers movies, where to me, those are the turn your brain off because you don't even want to think about what's going on there because it will drive you nuts. Nothing makes sense. It's all different shades of metal clashing into each other. And it's loud and noisy and fiery. So we come out of it thinking, you know, our body has been assaulted that way. We think we saw something intense and exciting, but all we saw was a lot of noise and movement. When you compare that to something like the Fast and Furious movies, and I would say that the opening scene in particular in The Fate of the Furious, the race in Havana, they just stand out to me as, again, these sequences where the filmmakers know what they're doing. They know where to place the camera. It is exciting. It is often loud, but it also makes complete sense. And even, you know, hits these sublime moments where that race does in Havana, where Dom spins his car in reverse to avoid the flames that are coming out of his hood. And then how that, I love how that scene ends. And again, it's the opening scene, so it's not a spoiler, but where the car he's driving in, he rolls out of it, it flips, it's on fire, and goes flying, of course, right into the water, right? It's just, it's like
calculated.
A punchline. Yeah, it's a punchline that the car, you know, gets doused and the fire goes out, and also a perfect ending to the scene. So maybe these are simple pleasures, but again, when most action movies can't manage this sort of competence, I really appreciate them.
So so comparatively, I have Blake on. Blake, hey, what's going on? I know we just kind of I know we just kind of jumped into it, but
that's fine.
I know that you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you'd seen like the first one, but then you had kind of not followed the series as well, right?
Yes, until Fast Five.
Okay, and so...
And then I saw it in theaters.
You saw Fast Five in theaters? Okay.
I rewatched it, and then I watched 6, 7, and 8 within about a week's time.
So I'm kind of curious, you skipped, what, 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah, so I still haven't seen those, which is kind of sad because I was looking back at the directors of those films, and I'm a huge John Singleton fan. And so Too Fast, Too Furious is a Singleton joint. And so I was thinking to myself, like, I feel like I need to go back and watch this one because I am a little bit of a completist on some levels.
So I'm kind of curious what your thoughts were, like, just now coming to the catching up with the franchise.
Yeah, so I didn't see 2, 3, 4. So what I know of the series is basically the first one, which is still my favorite to this day. I think it's the, as far as the efficiency of filmmaking and kind of scope of what it was trying to do, it's the best film of the series. Admittedly, you know, as you kind of grow in the franchise, you need to make it bigger and a little bit more bombastic. That's just the nature of franchises. It's still my favorite because it's kind of small, intimate, and I, like Josh, I am a big fan of the Paul Walker, Vin Diesel dynamic. And so I really appreciated that aspect of it. And it actually, I didn't see it until it was on video. And so I kind of fell in love with the first film and I felt it was a good, not only a good action flick, but just kind of brought me into a culture that I had no investment in. And so it was a film that I can kind of lose myself in. So as the franchise moved on, like I went to see Fast Five in the theaters. And I remember just thinking to myself, you know, if Vin Diesel and The Rock show up in the same movie, it's going to create a black hole in the universe and we're all going to get sucked in. And so I had to go see that event happen. And so I went to see Fast Five, and I remember enjoying it, but not really being really drawn in by it. And so that's why I didn't really follow the series after that either. And so the idea of doing this podcast allowed me to revisit and bring me to a point where I could watch 6 and 7 and eventually 8. And, you know, I don't hear a lot of praise for 6, but I think it may be my favorite of the ones I've seen beyond 1.
Hmm.
1's still my favorite. So 6 is weirdly my favorite of the last 4.
Well, it's weird to me to hear either of you heap so much praise on the first one still, considering it doesn't have 2016's highest grossing actor and my personal man crush, The Rock, in it. So
yes.
I feel like understandable. Yeah, I mean, like, I really didn't even get into the franchise very much, and I mentioned this on the Furious 7 podcast until my man crush was in the series, and I'm like, man, this is what this needed. It needed some machismo more than just like a grumbling kind of brooding reluctant hero. It needed someone willing to step out and say, hey, this is all ridiculous, and y'all know that, right?
That was definitely the turning point in the franchise. That's what they brought The Rock in to do. And I'm a big Dwayne Johnson fan too, but I've got to say, for me, the series did lose something a little bit there, because I did like it better, as Blake is saying a little bit at the beginning, when it wasn't aware of its own silliness.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't go so far to say that the original is a camp film. It's not that silly. It's just content to be this little genre piece done really well. And as you mentioned, I think, you know, a franchise gets bigger, it's got to do different things. They bring in Dwayne Johnson, and he brings with him his irony and his comic insincerity. That's part of what he does. And I appreciate that mostly elsewhere. But here it was kind of like, okay, now it's aware of it. It's aware that these movies are a joke, and it's in on its own joke, and that sort of lost something. Now, by the time we get to the Fate of the Furious, you know, The Rock was a welcome presence, because that movie, a lot of the early pleasures are gone at this point. And so The Rock, and along with Jason Statham, who played up his comic side, were some of the highlights for me. And this was played almost more as a comedy. So the time's long past where we're going to go back to that, sincerity of the first film. And they sort of embraced the comedy more than ever with new director F. Gary Gray and The Fate of the Furious, I felt.
Well, I think it's interesting that you point that out too, because it almost seems like one of the themes that they try to weave through the entire franchise is this concept of family. One that we've hit on before, and that we'll probably hit on a little bit later, but it almost seems like the more sincere they try to be now, the almost like, you're like, what are you doing? Like, just,
yeah.
Shouldn't Jason Statham be doing something like hilarious? Like I didn't think he could be that funny kind of hilarious, and just feels out of place. But what I'm actually curious about, and to a certain degree, it's going to be talking about the whole franchise, and at the same time, I'm kind of hoping there's something in the Fate of the Furious that this is hitting on too. But the Fate of the Furious just opened to the biggest global opening in movie history. And I'm pretty sure Furious 7 basically did something very similar when it came out 2 years ago, I believe. So this beat out The Force Awakens for global release dollars. Which is insane, right? So I think we can argue about, like, it's not intimate, or it's just a popcorn flick, or, you know, it's dumb action or whatever, but it doesn't change the fact that people are going to see these movies, and they're basically just cash machines at this point. And something is making people go see these movies. And I know it's a little presumptuous. It might be a little haughty for me to assume, but I don't think people are going because they have a critic's eye, like you pointed out earlier, Josh. Like, they're not going because they, like, you know, this action is really easy to follow. This is so much better than going seeing Transform. Oh, you know, this isn't directed like a Paul Greengrass film. It's not, you know, I don't think people are saying that. So like, Blake, do you have any idea, like, what makes people go see these films? Like, since they've completely changed tone, you know, it's not the Fast and the Furious anymore. It's, you know, this almost tongue in cheek kind of action series, but something's drawing them to it. Like, why are people going to see this? Not just like going to see it, but record numbers going to see these movies.
So just speculation on this point, because once again, I'm not, right? Yeah, exactly. And so I'm not an expert on this issue, but my guess is, like, same thing with Die Hard for me. Still to this day, no matter how bad the Die Hard films get, I will go see them in theaters because I know that I will appreciate Bruce Willis's self-awareness and action, the action quality of the films. And there's a little bit of a franchise element to this, that there's a quality that is expected and will be delivered upon to some degree. And so for some level, like, I think Fast and Furious fans are like, I've seen the first one, I've seen the second one, I've seen the third one. Third one was a little iffy from what I've heard. I still haven't seen it. So
but you're saying they kind of bought in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you tie into the series at that point. If you have two films and the idea of more than that coming up, you kind of become invested. And so on some level, as long as there's a connection between, you know, from each film to the last one that happened, there's going to be a tie and a reason to go see it. And so as long as Paul Walker or Vin Diesel or Jordan Brewster showed up, you're good to go.
Huh.
And so, yeah, it's just the nature of franchises. It's the same thing with Die Hard, same thing with Lethal Weapon, same thing with, you know, James Bond on some level. And so if you know that what you expect to see is going to happen, you'll go see it because you enjoyed it the first time, you'll enjoy it the second time, and no matter how ridiculous it gets, you'll enjoy it.
No matter how many submarines pop out of the ice.
Exactly.
Ridiculous. So,
yeah. Things.
Yeah. I think Bond is the apt comparison here because you're eight films in now, and, you know, I don't think, you know, Lethal Weapon hasn't done that. I don't think Die Hard has
come close to that. Yeah.
And at some point it does become self-perpetuating. So I'd agree with Blake on that. And I'd also add that these movies have multiple points of entry for audiences as they've expanded, as the cast has expanded. It's, you know, it has the car racing is one element of action. It also has the spy element, which is, I mean, some of these are essentially James Bond films.
Mm-hmm.
And this works really well as a soap opera. I mean, we've had major characters supposedly die and return. This has involved amnesia, literal amnesia mm-hmm. as a major plot point. And it works great. You know, I appreciate these films also as soap opera. So I think depending on what you're looking for as a mainstream audience member, there are a lot of points of entry here. I also don't think we should downplay the diversity of the cast, which has been somewhat there at the start and has only expanded.
Mm-hmm.
People were noting how, you know, this is a movie with a largely non-white cast that took the box office this weekend. And all of that, I think, just allows many different entry points for many different audiences that add up to this global box office phenomenon.
Well, justice for Han.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people get attached to these characters, right? That's one of the critiques of The Fate of the Furious, is that certain characters are behaving in ways they wouldn't or in ways that betray who they were in previous installments.
Which is one of my problems with it.
So. Is it? Okay. And that makes sense. When you have emotional attachments, that shows that these aren't just action flicks for people, right? That they've become attached to these characters. And when they see them being betrayed by the story, they don't like it.
So since we don't really mind spoilers on this, this podcast, I want to kind of jump in right there and get some clarification. I want some specifics, like how are characters acting different that are betraying their characters that we should be upset as audience members completely invested in these characters for, you know, 5, 6, 8 movies.
So I'm just going to pick on Roman here for a second.
Okay.
Tyrese Gibson. And just say, like, I feel like the big gag of the films has been over the past 4 films has been kind of making him the boisterous kind of showboat character. And admittedly, I haven't seen the second film, which is what showcases him and Paul Walker. And so I can't speak to the nature of that film, but I know I've read enough about that film to know that he wasn't exactly like he was a showboater, but he wasn't quite to the level. He wasn't ignorant.
Yeah. He's almost
like
incompetent.
Exactly. He's almost like he has no character outside of his bravado, which is a little, on some level, it's a little shameful. For the writers of these films to continue and to make worse on some levels, because it seems like every film, even, you know, my favorite of the last 4, 6, like it adds on to this idea that Roman is kind of this wisecracking guy who is completely clueless, and he just happens to be the guy that they throw in to soften spots and to distract. And that's really his only point, which is kind of the a version of, you know, kind of the magic black man, as they say, in horror films. He's there to assuage certain situations and to help the white characters in those situations. And so it's problematic in a lot of ways. And so I feel like the Fate of the Furious, like, it becomes almost to a spoof level. And so except for one scene, which I'm sure I'll bring up here before too long, where he actually has his own moment. And I think it's actually the best moment of the film, in my opinion. And so he actually takes control of his own being and his own persona, and he controls the situation. And he's not, you know, depending on the laughs or mm-hmm. anything like that. And so I just feel like there's a lot that could be done with him and Ludacris that is not done and is really kind of depleted by that aspect. And mm-hmm. and each film has kind of added to that depletion as they've gone on. So,
yeah, the unfortunate thing about Tyrese Gibson in the series, and I do, you know, he is comic relief and funny yeah. quite often, but this is a really good actor. You know, speaking of John Singleton, they made Baby Boy together
yeah.
Back in 2001, which was
really good
film.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is, you know, not using him in the way that it could. I think another character situation that came up with The Fate of the Furious is the Jason Statham character, who yeah. was, you know, a straight out villain in the previous film, to the degree that, you know, he took out family members, you know, family in quotes. I think he's the one who blew up Dom's house.
Yeah.
And that is yeah. all like quickly forgotten here in this film, in The Fate of the Furious. So these are just things that are, you know, character continuity. And I think why it rubs people the wrong way is it suggests that the filmmakers are not taking the movies as seriously as the fans, perhaps.
Oh yeah. That's
dangerous. That's a dangerous line for a franchise to play with. You can wink at yourself, you know, and you can nod at your own ridiculousness, but once you start doing things that suggest you're not really paying attention to what came before, or that it doesn't really matter to you, I think that can be a problem.
I'm sorry, I stopped listening there. I think you were talking about the X-Men films, or were you talking about Fast and Furious still?
Yeah.
For example. Amen to that. So that's what I'm kind of curious about. Like, the Jason Statham, like, I loved what I saw in Fate of the Furious, and it had been long enough since I saw Furious 7 that I was like, wait, wasn't he like a really bad guy? Like, I didn't really feel like they left the door open there for him to be misunderstood. But at the same time, since it had been long enough, I remembered the bits and pieces from like 5, 6, and 7, but I didn't remember the intricacies of it. So I was able to just kind of be like, whatever. He's funny. He's saving a baby. This is hilarious. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
and he is. I mean, he's, you know, he was so good in Spy, spoofing his own image, the Melissa McCarthy film. And he kind of carries a little bit of that over here. And he's definitely funny in the film. And I was a similar situation as you, Mikey. I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
It didn't really like gut me. But there are people who, you know, take it a lot more to heart, and I can understand that.
So, I mean, like, what is that? What are the consequences of that down the road? Like, cause I mean, they're already, if I'm not mistaken, they're already at least signed up to do at least two more. Like, where do they go?
Good question.
Like, are they just going to continue to get, I mean, I guess we don't know personally, but if we had to guess.
Yeah. You know, they're probably going to up the ante. It'll be a more ridiculous setting. I think at this point, you know, you're keeping Statham as a member of the team, so to speak.
Yeah.
And try to replace his villainous presence with someone new. You can't really, you know, make up for a character change like this necessarily. And we'll see how important, you know, they might also say, hey, we broke all these box office records. Who cares? We're going to do what we want.
We're just going to do what we want. People will keep seeing the movies.
And, you know, that's the weird thing about it is that within that scope of filmmaking, like, they may happen upon a movie or two that really are quite good, and yet the rest of them are just complete crap. And so, like, you know, it's like whenever you come to that point in a franchise, when you're like, we can just do whatever we want, that allows for a lot of creative freedom. And that freedom can allow for a lot of really bad choices and a lot of good, really good choices. And so we hope for the good choices, but that doesn't mean that we're always going to get that. And so I feel like you're going to get a lot more humor. They're going to take themselves a lot less seriously as the franchise goes on, which can go well if they do it properly. I just feel like the Fate of Furious did not even take a step in the right direction on that level, because I think they're starting to get to that point already where they're like, yeah, this is kind of silly. And we need to transition. And I don't think they quite figured out that transition.
What's interesting that you talk about, like, when you know that people are going to see your film because of either the name on it, or I would also add, like, because who's involved in it. Like, I'm going to go see just about any movie The Rock's in, because, again, man crush on The Rock. Nothing I can do about it at this point. So, like, much like I was curious if Josh had started talking about the X-Men films when he's making a comparison, I almost started hearing what you were saying, Blake, about, like, once full freedom is given, like, you have the potential to do something really amazing, but also something really awful in that freedom. Yeah. And I was like, that's exactly how I feel about Christopher Nolan. You know, like, his best is, like, still, it's like some of the best I've ever seen. But, like, when he's given complete freedom, the worst is almost unbearable. And
that's just the nature of choice, though. Like, that's the paradox of choice, is that constraint often breeds creativity. And whenever you're given full reign of budget and resources, your ability to create in a kind of a pressured situation becomes less. And so you get lazy on some level. And so Nolan, I feel like I still like Nolan as a director. I think
I'm going to watch Dunkirk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I feel like he's lost a little bit of his control. He's lost a little bit of his creativity because of his loss of freedom, or his gain of freedom, his loss of constraint.
Mm.
So, Memento is still Memento, The Following, and The Prestige are still some of my favorite films of his because he was still relatively unknown at that point. Like he had proved himself on some level with Batman Begins, but
he still had people. He was
still kind of figuring out his He still had people. And so now he doesn't really like he's still got a little bit of he's got a lot of a room to wiggle. And so that's why I was not as pleased with Interstellar as I was hoping I was and so forth. So, yeah, constraint can add a lot to creativity. And once you lose that, I think you lose a little bit of something in the making of films.
So it's interesting to me because I feel like if I'd have known that we were going to make that comparison at some point, I would have more prepared. But it really does remind me of like the beauty of constraint in the Christian faith. Not to do a Jesus juke here, but that's exactly what that makes me think about. One of the the complaints leveled about people who adhere to any religion, actually, like you're just putting yourself inside these rules, and that the paradox of actually being more free or inside a set of like set boundaries than you are with the gates flung wide open is like sure. I said, something I feel like I'm trying to formulate in my head right now. Again, I would have come up with some great segues and commentaries on it, but didn't know we were going to go there. Well, something I do want to talk about, is the concept of family, and I want to talk about it, or actually I kind of want to hear from you guys in almost a twofold way, because family is I think it was almost it was sidestepped into, and Josh, you mentioned this earlier, the diversity of cast, which is I think one of the reasons that these films are so globally accepted in the first place, kind of gives us this found family, this family that I think, especially as people become more transient, as people become more mobile, found family almost has a greater impact on people and kind of connects with people more than it does your biological family, because lots of people move away from the biological family. They have problems calling home and checking in with their moms. And, if you don't like your dad or you don't like your brother, honestly, like these days, you can just move to a different city and almost find a new family. So I think that concept of found family is appealing to people. And again, I think the Fast and the Furious kind of sidestepped into it. And then they, people started kind of lauding them for having this idea of family and this, pinnacle of family, and pointing all their films in the direction. And now I feel like they just mention it as much as they can. So I'm kind of curious, what are your thoughts, Josh, about family as a theme or a central point of the Fast and Furious franchise? And then where do you see, like, do you actually see family as an integral part of the fate of the Furious?
Yeah. I like how you describe it as they sidestepped into it and now won't stop talking about it, because that's exactly right. And it became something that did happen organically within plot developments in the first, the first film a little bit. And then once, so, I'm losing my continuity too, but by the time Vin Diesel and Paul Walker got back together, I think it was the third film. That kind of expanded this sense of, this group of people who were brought together and stood by each other, and there was loyalty and there was honor there, and also started to play with the idea of the both sides of the law and how their bonds existed across that divide. Those were all interesting things. And, you know, that last bit in particular has been part of cop narratives forever, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that all worked really well. And I think audiences did respond to it. And I think the filmmakers then felt the need to push that more to the forefront, particularly by giving Dom a speech in some way or another in the latter films about family. Yeah. And then closing with, you know, him saying grace as they gather together around a table. A nice image. You know, I don't necessarily mind that, but I do wish they talk about it a little bit less and just have it occur in the action and in mm-hmm. the things that we see. And I also think this is where the turn towards largely humor does undercut the series a bit as well, because once you start making fun of yourself, it's very hard to suddenly switch and have everyone gather together and pray at the end and take that very seriously when you've been joking for about how ridiculous it is. I mean, why are we not supposed to laugh at that then? I guess is the question that I find myself asking once everything has been, you know, up for grabs in terms of humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I feel like when I went to see this movie, I was like, going to see Fate of the Furious, hashtag family, 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 because the trailer is just like family, family, we're family. Yeah. You betrayed your family. I found my family, you know, things like that. And again, spoilers, pause. This movie like feels like it's throwing family at us, but it somehow seemed like it had less to do with family than almost any of the previous ones. And again, you know, Josh, you mentioned like they're talking about it a lot instead of showing us, but I feel like at the same time I'm seeing them, like Vin Diesel having to make this choice, you know, between like his found, well, I mean, I guess his wife and then his kind of found family and then his biological family. And is it the choice? Like, I'm trying to get you guys to analyze my own problem with the film. Is it the choice that he's making that makes me feel like it's not really about family? It's about some kind of personal, like maybe it's about legacy instead of family.
It's just a weird scenario all around that, you know, basically this baby he didn't know he had is being held hostage. And that's why he is forced to turn against the team and work for the Charlize Theron character, this cyber terrorist, right? Yeah. It's just an overly complicated idea. I honestly wish they'd given someone else amnesia. I think that would have worked much better.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, it's weird because I feel like on some level, he could have, I feel like the baby was kind of a grafted in notion, in the sense that like, hey, let's find something that Dom would turn against the rest of the crew. I feel like the worst part of this film is the fact that everyone on the other side of Dom, while he's kind of on the other side of the whole spectrum of the narrative, is questioning Dom. Whereas if you look at the franchise, there is no reason to ever question Dom. He's the most like stalwart individual in this whole concept of family. And so really, my biggest problem with this film is the fact that every character, including Letty and Roman and all the people are questioning Dom turning against them, and yet the main thrust of the film is not figuring out why he has turned against them, but it's actually trying to stop him.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so like really, like I feel like that actually subverts the whole family thing, because they actually don't trust him within the scope of this narrative.
Right. Well, and it speaks to your point about, you know, them trying to figure out where can they go next and having this sense of freedom. You have the sense the filmmakers think that this is a great way to jumpstart the franchise. Is Dom of all people is going to be a bad guy? What?
Yeah.
And in reality, that just kind of seems to be a miscalculation given what has come before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, does it maybe undermine family in general to, or when someone preaches family, and Dom seems to not trust his own family. Like I know, Cypher, Charlize Theron's character is kind of like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm going to throw away this line that says, don't tell anybody. He obviously was able to tell like the dude that he raced against in Puerto Rico, and whoever else that what was going on, but he couldn't like trust his own family just to be like, look guys, there's like, they've got someone I care about and I'll tell you about it. Like, we're still on the same team. Like, like for plot's sake, right? Like for the, ooh, why is he a bad guy?
Right.
Sake. It doesn't
for the trailer, essentially.
So, I mean, like, would that go back to being like, is that an egregious enough sin to be another instance of Dom or another instance of a character not being the character that people kind of loved? Like, does it make sense that Dom would do that?
I mean, I can see on paper how maybe it does, because they're literalizing the idea of family mm-hmm. by having his motivation be his own child. Right. So, yeah. So I can see again in the story meetings where it seemed to make sense, but on screen it doesn't quite play.
Well, I think, go ahead, Blake.
I was just saying, like, I think it's less a problem with Dom as it is with the rest of the characters. I think that their complete cluelessness when it comes to why Dom would do this is the problematic element of this film. Like, if they had been more graceful and merciful in their approach to why Dom would betray them, and possibly just throw out speculation as to why he might do this, I feel like this film would have been a lot shorter and a lot less painful. And so,
well, so you have a film that could have been shorter, but that wouldn't have been any fun.
Yeah, of course not.
I mean, except maybe it would have made a little more continuity sense, you know. But like I'm still a little bit confused at, or maybe I'm just a little bit let down, because again, I feel like they sidestepped into found family, but then they've really taken the reins on found family more so than most any other franchise, especially, but most even films. And like I said, they have the diverse backgrounds. It's like, it doesn't matter where you came from. The scene at the beginning, as kind of almost eye roll inducing as it is, when he doesn't take the guy's car because he's like, you know, now he's family and everyone's family and family. But like, it should.
Yeah, it's his cousin or something, right? Yeah, that he meets.
Yeah.
In.
Yeah.
So he's pushing this idea forward, and they're trying to sell us on found family. And then on a whim, Dom actually says, you know, what's more important than found family? The thing that I said is more important than anything, blood family. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to give it all up for blood family. It trumps everything else. It means I'm not going to talk to people. It means I'm not going to tell anybody anything. Because I have a son. Now, having a son, I completely get that. But it does seem. But then again, I'm not racing people in Puerto Rico and saving cars and jumping out of airplanes
I think what, you know, the assumption is that because this is Dom and we know he's, you know, undefeated in all the other movies, he's not making a choice here. He's playing his cards where for now he's got to protect the baby mm-hmm. while he can, you know, scheme to get back on the side of the team. So I didn't ever take it as a choice, more him just, you know,
biding his time,
work his way out of this. Yeah.
I was gonna say, it's so weird because I feel like they don't play Dom up. I think, at least from my perspective, they play him up as very opportunistic, but never like scheming.
Hmm.
And in this one, he seemed like he was like, that was my plan all along.
Yeah. Which I don't believe one second.
I think another issue here is that we're left with a lot of Vin Diesel. And I greatly appreciated his presence in the original, The Fast and the Furious. Again, I like that he plays this straight up, unlike Dwayne Johnson, and I think that fits for the best. But you also need that balance you always had with Paul Walker, who was a very affable presence, a very sunny presence, and it was the alchemy of the two of them. You know, they hit upon this sort of bro bliss where they had very different sensibilities, but you could tell that their characters connected over cars, and that was enough. They could just talk while fixing an engine and say a few lines, but they each knew what the other meant. And with Paul Walker no longer with the franchise, it's taken on a different tone by giving over to this grimness that Diesel naturally carries within him. But when that's all you get, it can be a little bit too much. And maybe they tried to balance that by, like I said, going humor with the way they're playing up more laughs in this installment, but it doesn't quite balance things out the way that Walker's presence did.
Yeah, because I feel like Paul Walker is kind of the, I guess, the new Keanu Reeves in a lot of ways. Like, I feel like he gets downplayed as far as his role in these films, is that he's universally hated in a lot of ways, and that he may not be the most versatile actor, but he fits the role. And so he plays a good balance against Vin Diesel. And that's what makes the first one, and I assume the rest of the franchise, work so well, is that he's kind of a nice counterpoint off of Vin Diesel. Mm. And so whenever they try to introduce Scott Eastwood, and I emphasize try, because I feel like...
Is he the fake Paul Walker? Is that...
Yeah,
that
I feel like he is. Like, I feel like they're trying to introduce him as the new Paul Walker.
Yeah, it's Kurt Russell's sidekick, right?
Little nobody.
Okay. Yeah, he does not work. Like, he's just... Like, the whole time I'm just thinking, he's going to say, "Do you feel lucky, punk? Well, do you?" You know, and so... Yeah, it's just rough to watch, because I feel like Kurt Russell has enough history on his own to where, like, he can do whatever he wants and people are going to be okay with it on some level. Scott Eastwood doesn't have that background. And so him showing up in this franchise trying to replace Paul Walker, who's been in 7 of these films...
Six of them, maybe.
It's going to 7. Like, he finished the filming of the of all 7 films, and then he died.
He wasn't in Tokyo Drift, was he?
Yeah, neither of them are in Tokyo Drift.
Oh, neither of them are in Tokyo Drift.
I think Vin Diesel shows up at the very end.
Very end.
Okay.
But that balance between them has been crucial to most of the films. Yeah. And it's not necessarily even what Walker does as an individual performer, it's more how he works in relationship to Diesel in particular, and you know, the whole communal vibe that these movies have.
Yeah, exactly. And it's weird, because I feel like Paul Walker may be the most stalwart character in this whole series.
So he does kind of a Keanu Reeves thing. You're right. Almost the Luke Skywalker standard, the everyman. Like, Paul Walker is a blank canvas, and we can see ourselves walking in and being entering into what Josh is calling bro bliss with Vin Diesel in these films. And I think that works. I think the bro bliss is a big thing. And I was wondering, did you guys also, it sounds like Blake, you did, but as soon as I saw Little Nobody on the screen, I was like, they're trying to replace Paul Walker with this guy, right? Like, that was like the first thing I thought.
And it just played as slapstick, and it doesn't work. It does not work at all. Like, the whole point where, so Rock, like, slams him up against the wall, like, sideways. And I'm just like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. This is literally the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And so, it just felt so detached from the whole series. And, you know, I didn't have the greatest, like, affinity for the series or the franchise as a whole. but I grew to love the characters. Mm-hmm. And that, like, Fate of the Furious felt like they were destroying a lot of the characters to me.
Well, I do think I was actually curious. When you have the Paul Walker, Vin Diesel dynamic, you do have something that I think we talk about a lot, which is that inability for men to have intentional conversations, but they can kind of say what they mean by saying what they don't mean while they're both fixing the car, kind of like you described earlier. And I think that is a connection point. And I think that is, again, part of that bro bliss. And I think they maybe misunderstood what that was, because to a certain degree, I think the whole turn with Jason Statham is them trying to get some of that bro bliss with The Rock and Jason Statham. You know, like the guys that are from different sides of the law who are misunderstood. Like, they're trying to pack like two movies worth of character development from, you know, Dom and whatever Paul Walker's character's name is.
Brian, come on,
Brian,
man.
Brian.
Whatever. He's Paul, the kid, Brian.
He's Paul Walker. That's the problem.
You're right about that scene with Statham and Johnson under a car, right? They're working on a car and have that exchange, which is really good. I thought that was pretty funny, actually.
So. Yeah, well, but it's like they try to, so they do that. They're taking all the elements, but they're cramming it into like this little about 10 minutes worth of development, and we're like, yeah, see, they're just misunderstood guys that are coming together, just like, you know, like they're replacing Paul Walker and Vin Diesel.
But that's the thing. I don't think it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the problem, is that, like, if you tie a franchise to two certain individuals with Paul Walker and Vin Diesel on some level, like, you have to tie it into them.
Yeah.
You can't just create two new people and expect it to work the same way.
Well, you can expect it to work in a different way. You just have to give it the same time and love.
Yeah, exactly. And which they didn't. And so you either have to tie Statham in with Vin Diesel, or you need to tie The Rock in with, you know, some other scenario here. But you need to give a couple of films for that to develop instead of one film.
We don't have that kind of time. We're making money
exactly.
here, Blake.
Yeah, exactly. No doubt.
Well, before we completely, or before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you guys kind of like a big picture kind of overview of this film. I'm kind of curious, Josh, what does the Fate of the Furious specifically do pretty well for you? And then where does it fall short? So, and by answering those two questions, I'm kind of hoping you almost hit on a third, which is, what, if anything, are you hoping to see from one of the next two installments?
Yeah, so I think I hit on the things that I did have trouble with, and it is probably some of the character stuff. But I think it also does capture those moments of Zen chaos that I'm mostly looking for. As much as I appreciate the soap opera angles, it is as formerly rigorous action films that I appreciate these first. And that opening scene in Havana, the race they have there, mm-hmm. I think does that. It actually reminded me a little bit of the pod race in The Phantom Menace, where they're using, instead of the sort of caverns that the pod racers go through, these are Havana streets, which are at these acute angles. And you can see them in overhead shots, both at the same time, kind of careening towards each other. I just think it's really well done. And, you know, if there is still a future for the franchise, I hope that they get back to that. The submarine sequence at the end probably is what people are going to be talking about. And there are some good moments there, but it relies a little bit too heavy on CGI for my liking.
Yeah.
A lot of these best stunt scenes involve practical effects in this franchise. So I'd hope for a return to that as well. And it's just, you know, the little moments that really work in the sub scene. For example, Dom jumps the sub, okay, in his car. And I just love describing this. And if people haven't seen it, what they're imagining.
These are actual sentences that I'm describing from a real movie. Yeah. That was made. So
he jumps the sub, which is ridiculous. But they have that little detail where the tower of the submarine nicks the back tire of his car, right? And spins a little bit. So it's stuff like that that I've always appreciated, that attention to detail that I hope they'll continue. It's really what, you know, I focused on when I did write about this Think Christian at Think Christian. People are probably wondering, how in the world did you write about this at Think Christian? And I realized, you know, the transcendental moments for me in this series are not those like in a lot of action movies where things are being destroyed or being assaulted, but they're when heroes outwit certain death. And so when you think about the last two films in particular, breaking box office records on Easter weekend, there's something here about the idea of death being turned on its head. And you see it in the scene of Dom jumping that sub and just barely making it. There's a similar scene in The Fast and the Furious where Dom and Brian are in a race down a street and they have to cross a railroad track just in time and they barely make it with the train. It's like this bulleting blur behind them. Fast Five, which a lot of people say is their favorite, there's this slow motion leap from a Corvette that's going off a cliff and they both survive somehow. Yeah. So I do like how this series hits its best beats when it's turning death on its head.
Mm. Also, what I'm hearing you say is that if he's not too busy, you would like to see a Fast and Furious movie made by like George Miller.
Oh, man. No, you're right. That's it, right? Mad Max Fury Road is the best action film we've had in years because it has exactly the sort of Zen chaos I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it's actually driving plot by action, which yeah. is almost unheard of. Yeah, so
you're right.
Yeah.
So Blake, I'm kind of curious. Same thing, you know. Like, I know you weren't incredibly happy with Fate of the Furious, but did it do anything to keep your attention?
So there is one scene and the only scene in the film that really kept me, like, actually kind of brought me out of my stupor. Was when Roman actually is being dragged by a car door over the last scene, like over the ice, and there's an explosion. He gets broken off from the car, and he's just like, "I've had enough," and so he gets up and he takes the car door and he slams it into the jet ski guy. And then he takes out a gun and he shoots the other jet skis guys. And I'm just like, this feels like a Fast and Furious film. In this moment, in this like short 10-second film, this feels like Fast and Furious. Because he's like, this felt like this almost got to the intimacy that I expected from the action from in a Fast and Furious film. And so that scene really woke me up. Like, there was no really action scene in this film that really kept me interested. Like, not even the Havana car race. Like, there were parts of it I thought was interesting, but I was just like, I've seen it before. Like, there's better done films that have done this kind of thing. And so when that happened, when Roman like finally just, and it was playing against type, like it was playing against what his character does. And I think that's what woke me up. I was like, oh, here's a little bit of life in this franchise. Like, Roman is playing against type. He's actually taking control of his character. And he's saying, you know what? Screw you guys.
Yeah, you but, know? But they quickly stop that, though.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that's why it's such a brief moment in the film. That was like really intrigued by the character development, because I felt like this was a moment for Roman that was very like almost Mad Max ish because it was developing his character in the sense that he just needs to be brought to a point and then he can actually become a really good leader, which is what he talks a lot about in all the films. And so, that scene just really stuck with me. And it's a really well shot scene, and I love F. Gary Gray, but I have not liked his last three films. I think they've been a little too showy, and
maybe you don't like him.
Kind of fits in. Well, no, I really like Friday, and I like really like Negotiator, and I like Be Cool, various other things, but it's just there's elements of it that like fit within the scope of what he's been doing lately that I don't like, and I feel like that's a pretty great moment in the Fate of Furious. Mm. I have little hope for the next couple of sequels, if not more, and I will probably go see them because I've spent the
last week. You're already invested. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm invested, and I've seen the last four films within the last week, and I kind of care about these characters. And so I kind of want to see what happens to them. Hmm.
I think I was going to say, I didn't realize that F. Gary Gray did Be Cool. Because speaking of my man crush, I think that's my favorite role that The Rock's ever been in.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. compared to, like, the only one that might compare to it is Southland Tales, Richard Kelly. I love that film so much.
Yeah, it's that's good.
It's stupid as hell, but it's great. So.
Well, so when I think about The Fate of the Furious, I was, like I said, I was really enjoying this film. And I think it's for two reasons. One, because I really didn't get into the Fast and the Furious franchise until, like I said, The Rock came in and turned it into something different. I really didn't connect with it as kind of like the get on board with the Fast and Furious and get with the characters. I didn't like Paul Walker. And I didn't really care for Vin Diesel, even though basically he's in all my favorite movies of all time. So the idea that they're ridiculous and they're international spies and it's kind of more funny than serious, like when they go in that direction, I tend to enjoy it, meaning that I'd enjoyed this movie quite a bit, but I also learned my lesson from the trailers for Furious 7, which showed the two or three most ridiculous stunts of the movie almost in their entirety in the trailer. And I was bored through most of Furious 7. So this one, whenever the trailer came on for it, I kind of did like one of those, like, you know, see nothing, hear nothing, kind of na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Mm-hmm. And so I had no idea. So I had no idea there was going to be a submarine in it. I had no idea, you know, any of the crazy things that we're going to do with the wrecking ball or anything like that. So I was pleasantly surprised. I feel like I got my money's worth. And the two scenes in The Fate of the Furious that I enjoyed the most, again, were the most Fast Five kind of rebootish scenes in the film, in my opinion, which were, one, the Jason Statham and The Rock escaping prison scene, which was ridiculous. And I was sitting there just grinning, being like, this is the most ridiculous thing. This is
a great
setup
to that too, with them chirping at each other across the hall. Yeah.
Yeah. Just kind of bickering back and forth. Like, you know, so anyway. And then the scene with Jason Statham on the plane, kind of shooting people in the face while cradling the baby. I was just tickled. I was like, as soon as he said, like, this is going to be like messy, but you're going to enjoy it or something like that. I said, I'm getting ready to really enjoy what's coming next. And I kind of hate myself a little bit for it. And it was great.
I feel like that's a very Jason Statham thing to do. Like, I haven't enjoyed a Statham film since Transporter.
Oh yeah. That's an action movie that knows what it's doing for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so like, if you enjoy Statham as an action star, you'll enjoy this film. But if you don't enjoy film, like the way action film is done, then you'll have issues with the way this film wraps up.
Well, I think
with, yeah, so, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the things that I can't, I, I just kept thinking when I left this film is that even though I think people are getting on board, I think the comedic timing or comedic chops of The Rock and Jason Statham are criminally underestimated. I saw Central Intelligence last year, and even though he was in a film with Kevin Hart, The Rock was the funny one. And I don't think that was like intentional, like 100% intentional. Yeah. Josh, you mentioned Spy. My favorite part of Spy, was Jason Statham, like by miles and miles and miles.
It's a great scene.
I feel like there's just nothing I'm not willing to give them a chance on right now, because I think they've got to a point in their careers where they can do action and I'm going to enjoy it. They can do comedy and I'm going to enjoy that too. And I think that is not something that you can say about a lot of people. So I'm going to keep seeing these movies because I know they're going to be in them, and I know it's going to be, you know, purely entertaining, and there'll be something to talk about, and people are going to pay billions billions of dollars to go see these movies.
Yeah, probably.
And my favorite film critic is Mark Kermode, and he loves Jason Statham. I have no idea why. So
maybe you've never seen a Jason Statham movie then.
I've seen a lot of them, and the last one I enjoyed was Transporter. So
I think it's completely interesting to me that these films are so incredibly popular when on the surface they seem to be doing so little. But Josh, I really appreciate kind of that perspective you brought. I don't think I've ever actually kind of thought about it that way, with this controlled, very easy to follow action. I think that's a really great point. And Blake, I'm really hoping that you can kind of get on board a little bit more. I like that you're admitting that you're in. So it doesn't matter.
I'm in. any films that are made at this point, I'm ready to go see.
They've got your money.
So, yep.
So right. With that said,
And I really like Vin Diesel and I like The Rock. So there you go.
Well, like I said, Vin Diesel is basically in some of my favorite movies of all time. Yep. And it boggles my mind because I keep being like, Vin Diesel sucks. I'm like, but he was in Saving Private Ryan. I'm like, dang it. I'm like, Vin Diesel's awful.
Let's be honest. He's the only part of Saving Private Ryan. So.
So that's the thing. But he's like, he's Groot. He's the Iron Giant. I mean, like, he makes me cry. I can't help it. Why are you doing this to me, Vin Diesel? Well, so we've reached that time. I think we've had a great conversation about the Fate of the Furious and the Fast and the Furious franchise in general. Kind of again looking at why people are going to see this, why it's represented so well globally and not just here in America, and the fact that there might be just a little bit more there, like there is with all entertainment, than we would originally think. So great conversations happen because we have great guests. So Blake, can you let people know how they can follow your work or get a hold of you online?
Yeah, so you can find me at Blake I Collier, Collier.com. And you can read my column at Real World Theology called Oh the Horror. I'm the horror guy, as Mikey Fizzle has declared. I live and breathe horror films. And so you can read my column there, and you can find any of the stuff I've written at various sites over at my website. And you can find me at Twitter at Blake I Collier.
Oh man, since you're the horror guy, I wish there was a way I could listen to like a podcast that you did about horror. That would be great.
Oh yeah, it's crazy because I feel like we've just become part of the Real World Theology podcast network, right? Called The Body, The Blood, which has just started up at the end of March. So
nice.
We'll have a new episode at the end of April, and we'll go from there.
Nice.
Sounds great.
So Josh, the same thing. I know that you have your hands in a ton of things and maybe have some interesting, very cool things coming up. So how can people follow your work, get involved with what you do?
Pretty easy to find me online as Larson on Film. It's LARSEN. That's the name of my website too. And then I write about film from a Christian perspective at thinkchristian.net. I talk about film on the Film Spotting podcast. And yeah, I've got the book coming out pretty quickly here. June 13 is the release date for Movies Are Prayers. So you can pre-order that if you're interested, as it sounds like it's sort of an attempt at specifically Christian film criticism, discussing how movies might function as various forms of prayer, like lament or confession or praise, those sorts of things. So that's been a fun project to do. And this has been good talking with you guys. So thanks for the invite.
Yeah, and already pre-ordered.
Oh, excellent. Thanks, man.
I was going to say, where's a good place to go to pre-order that?
There's this big online bookstore that has it. But, you know, if you have your favorite independent bookstores, I think they'll be getting it soon as well. So, yeah. But right now, if you want to get an order in, you could go to Amazon.
Gotcha. And we'll make sure we have all the links to both those guys' work in the show notes. So, you know, go to realworldtheology.com, find this post, and check out all their work, because they are doing some really good stuff, especially if you're interested in the intersection of faith or theology, especially the Christian perspective and entertainment in all its various forms. So check that out. Like I said, realworldtheology.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Physification. If you'd like to support the show, which I encourage you to do, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com/support. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. For Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
If you have something to say, say it. If not, then we'll move on. Hopefully it'll be more than Blake just going, "This was terrible." That's the general goal. So
all right.